certitude here. So I suggest we move slowly till we become acclimatized to the new atmosphere. If we move back one paragraph, we're on page 195. We've just had this review of the attributes and qualities, the characteristics of a seeker, a true seeker, a seeker after the object of his quest, which Baha'u'llah identifies as the Beloved, that is the embodiment of the names and attributes of God that appear in the manifestation of God, that appears as the manifestation of God. That power, that unique power that has the capacity to awaken within us the greatest gifts that God has given to us. That power without which those gifts will never be awakened. How can we draw into closeness? How can we draw nigh unto this power of the manifestation? How can we commune with this power sufficiently so that we will, so to speak, break free of the gravitational pull of the world and soar in the outer space of spiritual wisdom and knowledge? He's telling us these characteristics, these qualities will prepare us for such a step. Or perhaps they will progressively, almost in the form of layover qualities, they'll bring us to the point where the dawn of this new kind of perception, where the inception of this new dimension of flight will become apparent to us. The soul has flashes from time to time, foresights, sometimes in a moment of intense prayer, sometimes unexpected. The spirit visits and somehow everything resonates the right way and you catch a fragrance of this state, a touch of it, and it's gone again. The Master said, to attain to the height of fidelity or faithfulness is very difficult indeed. He said it's more difficult to remain constant in that position. Sometimes you get to a moment of seeing, but then you slip back again. The whole purpose, as I understand it, of the prayers for steadfastness and constancy are not simply that one should remain a Baha'i and be faithful to the covenant and serve the cause, but beyond this, there is the dimension of attaining to constancy in our communion with this power of the manifestation of God, with this other way of seeing, with this other way of hearing. It's a sublime goal. It is the outcome of heroic lives, of sacrifice for the cause. Baha'u'llah says, if you want to come to this station, then tuck your head under your arm and come. You may have to throw it out in the path. This is not a game for children. This is the whole of the eternal purpose of existence. We are told it's not easily gained. Abdu'l-Bahá says that until the spiritual power takes possession of our lives, we should withdraw, we should pray, we should commune, we should earnestly seek after spiritual things. We should leave off attraction to material pursuits. Now we have the necessity to some degree, to a certain degree, to remain in touch with everything around us and with our work and with our service and clothe ourselves and feed ourselves. Isn't that we can run away from these things? But they shouldn't be the first things on our agenda. This other thing, even though it's not there, but the prospect of it being there, somehow has to be awake and alive in the soul and heart of a human being for that entity, for that being to be a human being. The world is full of sleeping people. The world is full of wasted lives, in a sense. All of us, to some degree, are attracted and then retreat. Attracted and retreat, even though we are Baha'is. It's a very elusive thing. It's, how can we say, the greatest gift. It's closely associated with service in the sense of service as mediating this power of the manifestation. But then that's described in different ways. It's described as being diffusers of divine fragrances. It's described as being the spreaders of divine light. It's described in innumerable ways, but if I understand these things, these verses correctly, it all comes to mediating or reflecting these powers that are coming from the manifestation of God. These rays of the sun, of an invisible sun of truth, which shine on an invisible mirror of human reality, invisible to us outwardly. The heart has capacity to recognize and orient itself to the east of divine knowledge. It knows how to do that. It is called, it is attracted. If we provide it with the correct spiritual nourishment, it will gain strength and fly to its source. That state, we're told here, is to cleanse the mirror of the heart, which is the seat of these ancient mysteries of God, these spiritual perceptions and truths, this great vision, this new eye, this second birth that the Christians are going on a lot about, but don't seem to be able to describe very much. This all rotates around the question of cleansing the heart. Okay. Now, we've read earlier that there is an obscuring dust of acquired knowledge. We have the problem of having seen or been taught by people who view life according to certain standards, which are not the standards of Baha'u'llah. These have been inculcated to us, into us by society. Sometimes by non-Baha'i parents, by school teachers, by a whole system of education which generally doesn't mention the existence of God or finds it inappropriate or unnecessary. A total distortion of the reality of existence upon which we are fed from the time we're small. We're told to be practical, we're told to be moderate, all of which mostly is another way of steering us away from the lure of these great spiritual prizes, in a sense. How can we come alone with our purpose in our hand asking Baha'u'llah to help us out of this mesh of veils and illusions and deceptions? How can we find what God has made us to exist for? How can we penetrate to this reality? How much is it worth to us? He says that the heart is the sanctuary of the abiding love of the beloved. Down through the centuries, we can read the story of the spiritual adventure of those souls, oftentimes referred to as mystics, the meanings of whose lives have many times been confused by the contemporaries that lived around them, some of them having attained to martyrdom because of their excesses of attraction and outlandish statements, which were outlandish in one set of circumstances and one way of understanding, but yet in another were, if you will, preludes to this tremendous symphony of expression that Baha'u'llah has placed in the Iqan of what this means. Souls that talked about their beings, their inner beings being needed by the love of God, by God somehow infusing into them a whole new existence, closely related to their devotion to Christ or to Muhammad or to Jehovah in the case of the Jewish mystics. But if you survey religious literature, you find that the spiritual truths which have animated the hearts of human souls down through the ages are very, very similar. They're dressed in new garments. They are clothed in poetic phrases. But essentially what's being said is that the base metal of existence, or of our existence, is susceptible to influence by spiritual fire, by the fire and light of God, by the fire of the love of the Beloved. And if it approaches the fire, if it is attracted to the fire and moves towards it, it gradually is overtaken by the qualities of the fire. So that this metal, which in the beginning was cold and hard and dark, begins to take on the qualities of the heat, the warmth, the heat, the incandescent fire, luminosity, and liquidity of molten metal. It becomes so much like fire that you can't distinguish it from fire. Abdu'l-Bahá uses this example to speak of the kind of transformation that should take place in human existence, in the soul. We have the most great fire, if you will, the most great heat that's ever been released to this planet in recorded religious history. In the revelation of Baha'u'llah, he's brought us the most perfect expression, the highest form of all of these divine teachings of the past. In some cases, it took only a few verses to transform those souls that were ready to be ignited. Abdu'l-Bahá, in another tablet, he describes how some souls are like oil. The moment the spark touches them, they ignite. Other souls are more like rocks. You heat them and heat them and heat them, and as soon as they move away from the fire, they cool off again. Those are the souls that need to remain very close to the fire to keep warm. In conversations about teaching, he said, there are some souls also like green wood. They need to be close to the fire. But in the meanwhile, you know, if you put green wood near the fire, it smokes a lot. Now maybe you'll remember some seekers who went through that stage while you were teaching them. The smoke of doubts and problems until this wood finally dries out, and then it flames up, then it catches on. Now we shouldn't have prejudice against any of these stages. We should treat each as we can and try to guide them to illumination. Now, one of the problems we have is that Abdu'l-Bahá says that unless you're detached, you can't teach detachment to others. Unless you're inflamed with the fire of the love of God, how can you inflame others with it? Which makes a problem for all of us, especially for those that have to sit and talk about this. because, again, the constancy is not always there. But we want to examine these things together. We want to try to imagine, we want to try to visualize, what is it that Baha'u'llah is calling us to? We want to take advantage to the measure of our capacity, of our immediate capacity, from these passages to accelerate our search, to intensify our longing, to reflect upon the possibility that awaits us through correct, intense spiritual devotion. What possibilities are there? How this will assist the cause of God to be spread? How this will assist the organic character of the faith by bonding us to other souls who are attracted in such a way, and forming more of the very heart of this organic body of the cause of God? How we will become greater reflectors of the bounties and mercies of the Lord during the time that we live here. Most of what happens to us will depend on us. Everything else is in place. It's a matter of how we view these things, how real the possibilities seem to us, how deeply we might be motivated to place ourselves spiritually before Baha'u'llah and beg his guidance and repent of that negligence, that heedlessness which has hitherto characterized our existence. Now, I think we can say that safely, because all of us have to repeat this in the obligatory prayer every day, the long obligatory prayer, the short obligatory prayer. We all testify to our poverty and to God's wealth. And no matter how much we advance in this line of repentance, we never get beyond it, so to speak. It is a protection in itself. It leads us into the fair weather of the fear of God, where we are able to survive and we're able to be again more constant in our relationship to this potential and the expression of it. The other thing to remember is that each of us has a special endowment. Each of us is a unique expression of divine names in measures different one from the other, so that we are more similar and more like sheep in a flock when we are living our material existence than when we begin to express spiritual existence. Think of those souls that you know, that you admire as having attained a certain degree of spirituality, a certain intensity of service in the cause. Think how different they are one from the other. Think how different they are from many others, from the whole body of the believers. If you think of the hands of the cause, you see how unique. If you wanted to say what was similar in each one of them, it would be very hard to say. I remember the hands saying they were examining each other to see what are the qualities of a hand, if they wanted to appoint more hands, or if there was such a way to do it. How would they know what to choose? They couldn't find any similar pattern. They all were so different. But they all have a certain intensity of uniqueness. That intensity of uniqueness, if I understand it correctly, is a sign of the oneness, of the singularity of God reflected in your being. Your being has to be a singular expression in the world of existence of his particular qualities that he's placed in you. Now, he's placed all of his qualities in all of us. So each of us is a unique display in different proportions of divine qualities and names, inherent, latent, potential within us. The more we draw under the source of this life, the more that unique expression of our existence will become apparent and manifest in service to the faith. The more we will be protected from error and from shortcomings. The more we will play the role that the soul is destined to play by its endowment. If we don't take this step of heroism, if we don't move forward in this spiritual adventure, we deprive not only ourselves of the great gifts and bounties that await us, but we also deprive the world order of Baha'u'llah of those qualities. Because the role you can play, nobody else can play. They may play another role, but that particular expression of the power of God that you've been endowed with is going to get lost unless you cultivate and develop it and place it at the service of Baha'u'llah. In the next world, Baha'u'llah says one of the activities of the companions of the Crimson Ark, the people of Baha, it is to witness the reality of every sanctified soul. Now, that may sound very curious, except if you think of it in terms of what we're just discussing. A sanctified soul is a soul from which the pith of self has been blown. Its melody is a clarion, clear melody played by the divine player, so that the sound of that instrument is released to perfection. It is a crystal, luminous, gem-like crystal of a soul, refracting lights of the kingdom and colors of the spiritual realm in a unique manner that reveals to us something else of the hidden face of God. So the witness of the people of the kingdom, of the concourse of high, has the collective effect of placing us in a tremendous spiritual setting in which our own light will become intensified and enriched because of the principle that Abdu'l-Bahá states in his tablets of light upon light. If sanctified souls are brought into conjunction with each other, their light moves and interacts from one soul, from one heart to the other, and becomes light upon light. Now you can imagine the kind of binding that takes place, and this happens to us sometimes in Baha'i meetings, sometimes in large Baha'i conferences. There is this hidden linking that takes place and lifts us all, causes the whole conference to soar. Shoghi Effendi says, the blessings of the Holy Spirit. It's attracted because the souls come together for spiritual and divine purposes. He said there will be an attraction of this power into those meetings, into those gatherings. Now, here we gather with the House of Justice, we gather on the holy days, we gather in the shrines. There are so many opportunities to develop and nurture this relationship. When we go out from here, with all the possibilities of service open, in a world that's practically empty of Baha'is, less than 1% of the world's population has entered the faith. It isn't that we're going to find nothing to do or who shall we teach. It's still all before us, and it will be still for another century or two. If we take steps, early steps, to move through these prerequisites, if we ask Baha'u'llah to assist us in the attainment of some of these qualities at best anyway, and all of them if he will help us somehow, then we can come to the threshold of this promised transformation. Only when, page 195, only when the lamp of search, of earnest striving, of longing desire, of passionate devotion, of fervid love, of rapture and ecstasy is kindled within the seeker's heart, and the breeze of his loving kindness is wafted upon the soul, upon his soul, will the darkness of doubt be dispelled, the mists of doubts and misgivings be dissipated, and the lights of knowledge and certitude envelop his being A lamp then has to be set within us of search, of striving, desire, devotion, love, rapture, and ecstasy. It's not about to happen to us without us knowing, it sounds like. These are certainly qualities and conditions which will be apparent to the heart. Then this breeze of his loving kindness is wafted upon his soul. In some of the other tablets, Baha'u'llah talks about how the breezes of God waft through the tree of the soul. You know, it's as if our being were like a tree with leaves. And these breeze, this invisible breeze, you can't see it anywhere, and yet all the leaves are set a shimmer. The light reflects and catches them and moves through you, shivers your whole being, so to speak. You don't see what it is, it comes, you feel it, you feel the movement, you see the effect. But the wind itself is invisible. Someone asked the master about wanting, before they gave themselves to religion, wanting to have time to get to know their own selves. And he comments that without light, looking for our inner being, looking for ourself, is destined to fail. Because without light, you don't see anything. So then, unless you bring to bear upon your search for yourself the light of the Holy Spirit, it's like going into a cave without a lantern or without a spotlight. You don't see anything. You can grope around and feel certain limits, but you won't know. You might be in a cave filled with diamonds. You might be in a cave filled with gold. You're not going to know anything about it. But if you bring the light of the spirit of faith produced by the manifestation, then you can illumine the whole range of your inner being. And then you will come to understand your true reality. And this is the missing thing that society still hasn't understood. And when the souls come into the perception of such bounties, what can move them from the path? And that's what makes the community so solid and so distinct and different, and a magnet to attract the rest of mankind. Now Baha'u'llah announces to us here, at that hour will the mystic herald, bearing the joyful tidings of the Spirit, shine forth from the city of God, resplendent as the morn, and through the trumpet blast of knowledge will awaken the heart, the soul, and the spirit from the slumber of negligence. Then will the manifold favors and outpouring grace of the Holy and Everlasting Spirit confer such new life upon the seeker that he will find himself endowed with a new eye, a new ear, a new heart, and a new mind. He will contemplate the manifest signs of the universe and will penetrate the hidden mysteries of the soul. Gazing with the eye of God, he will perceive within every atom a door that leadeth him to the stations of absolute certitude. He will discover in all things the mysteries of divine revelation and the evidences of an everlasting manifestation. The question of conferring a new life upon the soul has to be understood, of course, within certain limits. As exalted as such a new life may be, one must remember the restrictions placed upon the human condition, the human spirit itself. and the essential dependence that the human spirit has on the spirit of the manifestation. Shoghi Effendi explaining this in a letter written on his behalf, he refers to this theme. He says, you'll remember in the hidden words, in the Arabic hidden words, number 13, about finding God standing within us, mighty and powerful, and what's the third word? Self-subsistent. So someone is asked, you mean God will stand within me? God will be in me? So he says, that which Baha'u'llah declares we can find abiding within us is the power of Divine Spirit, the reflection of the light of His revelation. This reflection of the Divine Spirit, however, can in no wise be compared to the revelation which God discloses to His prophets and messengers. The similarity in the terminology should not confuse this distinction, which is most fundamental. In another place, the Master explains that we should clearly understand the difference between within, in the sense that wine is poured within a glass, and in the sense that a reflection is found within a mirror. This within, God standing within us, he said, is of the latter kind. It is not God poured in us like wine in a glass. It is the reflection of the light of the manifestation of God, which then constitutes God within us. It is what he has ordained as constituting the knowledge and love of God, which he states is the animating purpose of creation, that man, the human soul, should attain to those understandings. The qualities are in us, the qualities are reflected in us.
They also it's not like the wine.
It's also not like the wine, because the qualities themselves are like lights. In that sense, I mean, I think they're like rays, they're like lights, in the sense that if the soul is cleansed, if it's been transformed from dirt into crystal through this influence, if it's taken on again the qualities like metal which is placed in fire, in that sense, it becomes imbued with those qualities. If the soul turns away again from that, it will the qualities will die out again. In other words, the spiritual qualities depend on a constancy of relationship with Baha'u'llah to be present. Does anyone have some other thoughts on that? The qualities, please.
Well, there's so many analogies with the wine and loving wine. So, what is it?
Well, the wine, being filled with the wine of the love of God, is different than being filled with God. In this sense, I think, you know, there is that other analogy too. There, the source of the inebriation is the Word of God, which produces both the heat or the fire of the love of God and the light of the knowledge of God. It has this dual dimension of, just like the rays of the sun have both heat and light. They have these two qualities to them. Sometimes we're more influenced by the one, especially in August, and sometimes we're more influenced by the other, the heat and the light. Some more. All right, now, this is very heavy going, I think, in one sense, because we're always trying to penetrate, to find out what do these things mean. What is Baha'u'llah talking about? Is there any way we can understand it unless it happens to us? How can we move towards keener awareness of what this is, what these implications are. I hope that you have something to say now. Do you have some thoughts? You must be thinking about these things. Have something you want to add? Comments? How many times have you read this passage? Many times. No? First time? Many times?
Now, why don't you just go ahead and give us an answer to that?
How many times? I don't know.
No, the question about how we gain that keener understanding.
How we gain the keener understanding? Well, collect tablets that tell you how to do it. That's the only way I know. It's just watch for all the clues in the divine writings. We're coming shortly to this section on the city of God. You will perhaps know that the city of God is identified as the Word of God. So he says that the joyful tidings of the Spirit shining forth from the city of God. As we become more oriented to the way of Baha'i life that Baha'u'llah is calling us to, the Word takes on greater luminosity. So as we read it, it's like when, you know, after you've read something and the first time maybe you read it and it didn't attract you so much, and you go back and you read the same book again. Maybe you've picked up Epistle to the Son of the Wolf again, starting to read this. So I read this before, but I don't remember any of this, you know. Look at this, what it says here. And you think, I have that marked, but I don't remember that at all. Each time we approach the writings, we find something new. And that's because our point of from which we're viewing the writings is changing, because we're moving, we're transforming. Baha'u'llah says, how can we grow spiritually? The house has been asked this too. The teachings are very clear about this. One set that the Guardian gave over and over for the Baha'is they should be busy with: prayer, meditation, study, and service or action. These four. Prayer, meditation, and study are all internal or spiritual functions in that sense, preparing ourselves so that the service or action can be effective. If we're assisted by God, he says, we will accomplish the purpose of God. We will be assisted to perform great works, great deeds for the faith. If we're not assisted, if we're motivated by desire for fame or for something of that sort, he says everything we do will come in the end to naught. All good proceeds from God, and all evil from our own selves. Paraphrase a verse in the Gleanings. He doesn't leave any margin. He doesn't say most of the good is from me and some little, of course you have some good too, but no, he says all good is from God and all evil is from your own selves. So this is again this dual nature of man. If we turn the focus of the mirror of our attention and being onto the lower characteristics, the animal characteristics, then we become, as he says, a prolific source of satanic power, diffusing it into the world. The dark forces which can take possession of the cultures and souls of men. Pretty frightening subject. But if we turn it towards the light, then we become light itself. And it's hard for the soul to be turned two ways at once. It reflects whatever it's facing. And the world and the spirit of Baha'u'llah are in opposition to each other. So we're either facing one or the other. And it's the same thing if you want to imagine it in spatial terms. We could say that the kingdom is here and the world is here. If you draw close to the kingdom, which is the way, rather than trying to get away from the world, getting away from the world is a kind of futile activity that ends up nowhere. But if you take and you turn your attention to the kingdom and you draw close to the kingdom, you'll find, of course, that you're drawing away from the world. You move away from the world as you move towards the kingdom. if you again focus your attention on the world and you become absorbed in the world and its affairs, then you draw away from the kingdom. That's two things in opposition to each other. Abdu'l-Bahá once said that the soul is like a bird. The higher part of the soul is like a bird, it's flying. The lower part of the soul is like a hunter. It's running along on the ground behind the bird, plotting how it can bring it down to the earth again. He said the soul has to exert itself, constantly be soaring, moving upward, keeping away from the hunter that's stalking it, looking to bring it down. He says that the hunter has a bow and he has a quiver, but he only has arrows when the bird has worldly desires. If the bird up there suddenly takes interest in something of the world and has an earthly affection or desire, he says immediately there's an arrow in his quiver. Then he takes that and shoots at the bird with it. With this I can bring him down. Otherwise he has no ammunition. So if the soul remains free of worldly ambition and desire, it can keep flying. And the hunter will get tired and dry up, and I don't know. We hope he will die a quiet death in the desert of abandonment there on the ground. But he's a very stealthy fellow. He lasts through thick and thin. He waits for the opportunity to grab the bird of the soul. Sometimes the soul, Baha'u'llah says in that tablet in Gleanings, as the soul comes down, he thinks, well, I'll just play a little in the mud here, you know? I mean, I'm a big, powerful bird. I'm always flying, and this is just, it'll be cool and nice. I don't know. I just try it out a little bit. Down there and gets a little mud on his wings and finds they're getting very heavy, and before he can move it, he's got himself covered with mud, and the mud is drying out, and the bird is not going anywhere. Then he has to sit and pick off the dirt off the feathers and the wings. It takes a long time. Lots of times to think about, what have I done? Why am I in this pickle here? What have I? Flying was so nice. Why has God punished me? The one about the bird in the mud is in the Gleanings. The other one about the soul and the hunter is in the it's in the Pilgrim Reports from Abdu'l-Bahá's time. I don't know right where it is. I read it a long time ago. I always remember it and I never know where to find it. So you have to repeat it as a pilgrim note. But be that as it may, it sounds very true, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds like the circumstances in which one lives. Dodging arrows and trying to keep your feathers clean. New eye, what are we talking about? New ear, new heart, new mind. Then he goes in another two sentences, he says, gazing with the eye of God. What happened to the soul now? Suddenly it's looking with God's eyes on things. What can this mean? What does it mean to gaze with the eye of God? What do the teachings tell us about it? I mean, what do we know about it? I don't know. But what does it mean? Gaze with the eye of God. What will it see if it gazes with the eye of God? What will he see? Quote the verse. You can at least say this. or that leadeth him to the stations of absolute certitude. Can we see some parallel between what happens to the crude metal that's subjected to the fire and it takes on the qualities of the fire? Before it felt like a rock, now it feels like fire itself. Before we saw with our own eyes, now we see with the eye of God. Because we're imbued with His Spirit, and He becomes the operative principle in our life. You remember in the Seven Valleys He talks about the mansion? The owner of the mansion comes into the mansion, the Lord of the mansion comes into the mansion, and all the pillars of the mansion are alight with His presence, aglow with His beauty. The human soul is that house. He says He won't come in as long as you have some stranger living in there. If we remove the stranger, then the proper owner will come in and grace it with His presence. Thy heart is my home. Sanctify it for my descent. We have ordained all things for you, except the human heart, which we have deemed to be our possession. Paulus says, this is the possession. Tells the kings and rulers in his tablets, think you that we've come to take your nations and countries? Said no. The eye of Baha is fixed on the hearts of men. That's the possession that he wants. Eye of God. What do you think this can mean? What else can we understand about this? What other examples do we find in the writings? How do you see now? What power is it that allows you to see right now? What power is it that the teachings tell us allows us to see? The mind? The light allows us to see, yes. But if we didn't have eyes, if we didn't have vision, the light wouldn't help. So, of course, light is one aspect of it. But what about the very power of vision? The eye? The pupil? The brain?
The spirit of Baha'u'llah is behind it all.
The spirit of Baha'u'llah is behind it all. We read earlier here that all things live and move and have their being in the manifestation of God. So it's the spirit, the human spirit, he tells us in other tablets and some answered questions, is an emanation from God. It's something proceeding from God. Creation is the breath of the merciful. This is a very interesting analogy he makes. The breath of the merciful. The breath of the all-merciful. Because the breath is something that comes out from you and then is separate from you, and yet it's from you. It's an emanation from you, but you are still you. You haven't lost anything by the breath that comes out from you. So God retains His identity, and yet He breathes existence at every instant. But that breath becomes life to human souls. Life to the cosmos itself, to all existence. It becomes the basis upon which the senses, the spirit of the mineral, the cohesive spirit of the mineral, the growth, spirit of growth of the vegetable, the sensorial powers of the animal, all of these things operate through spirit. It's the influence of spirit on undifferentiated matter, acting and drawing it in the field of its existence, energizing it and drawing it into the patterns that we perceive as material existence, as the outer forms of things. Form being the direct reflection of spiritual power. So we're seeing with a power that's proceeding from God, even now. What's the matter is we interpret it according to our inheritance. We interpret it according to the limited, isolated, individualistic outlook, which is very characteristic of the time we live in. What is it? The me generation? We have the possibility of seeing ourselves as individuals. We have the possibility of seeing ourselves as the breath of God or as an emanation from God. But we tend to identify ourselves at this end of the pole of the spectrum because, in a sense, we are an individualized center of consciousness. But that needs to be spiritualized by the realization that in its essence, man is this emanation, this spiritual emanation. As the soul orients itself to that understanding, as it captures and experiences that sight which is the reflection of the power of God, the all-seeing, is the animating force with which he sees. If we remove our individualistic and selfish purposes of existence from motivating us, then we begin to see God's purpose in things. In other words, we can see with the intention that God wants us to see. Because he's made the whole of existence as a book for us to read. And all these experiences are like the verses and chapters of that book. But we have to learn how to read it. And when we read a book, we'd like to come and commune with the author to see what he had in mind when he was writing this book. And so we come to commune with the purpose of Baha'u'llah, and we see with his eyes and we hear with his ears, even though this is a mute and very tenuous reflection of that power, yet it is the expression of those names of God within us, the all-hearing, the all-seeing, the all-wise, that endow us with the capacity to perceive in this new way. In relation to the cause, you mean, or Baha'i scientists? Or? Well, I think you have a different experience. First of all, you have the whole of creation is energized by these creative powers released by Baha'u'llah's revelation. So you have scientists that are animated by this, even though they don't know the source of it. And maybe even if they heard the source, they wouldn't readily recognize. But one would hope that they would be receptive if the faith were presented in the right light to them. Our prejudices hold us back. Our opinions hold us back. We hear that I have something important to tell you. The new religion, and then the other soul says, chung, and the door is closed. You know, they don't want to hear anything. Another religion, that's all we needed. And that's the end of the conversation. Otherwise, we have to find ways to present the faith, the reality of the faith, and somehow move through and around the opinions and prejudices of people. We have to study people and study society and study the cultural outlooks that people have and find ways around the obstacles so that they have a chance to witness light before they turn away from it. And even then it's a struggle because they'll have to come back to examining it. There's no way that you can get away from viewing the Baha'i Faith as a religion, but maybe you will have had a good healthy attraction to the manifestation of God and his beauty and his principles and all these other things that are given, that he gives us all these possibilities. You know, try taste this, see if this tastes good. Does that taste good? Try this. Does this taste good? Does that taste good? And finally he says, that tastes very good. And maybe if he eats a little more of this, he'll get appetite for some of the other food that's harder. Abdu'l-Bahá says that the principles of the faith are like milk. And the laws are like meat. You give milk to the children first till they get teeth, and then they can chew meat. So all of the teachings of the faith have to come in in a proper progression, in a sense. But the scientists, I think, are receptive to the inspirations of the day. So many discoveries have been made by non-Baha'is. It doesn't take a Baha'i to make discoveries. But how nice when these two are blended together. What will that reveal? Someday we'll have some great agency here in the Holy Land, the center of the sciences, the center of the arts of the whole planet, of which the leading and outstanding wise and great scientists will be members. And they will catalog and collect all the great inventions of announce these developments to the world. It'll be exciting.
Going through all this process of how we should get closer to God and how we should purify ourselves and the vision that God has given us. Why has He given us the choice, the will, so that we have to go through all this in order to get closer to Him? Why doesn't He just give us one vision to see the vision that we wanted to see? Why do we have this choice? If we have, we are to be attracted. Why do we have to go through all this?
Did you hear the question? Why do we have to go through all this? Why couldn't He have just... Why does He leave us with this choice? Why didn't He just give it to us? Why doesn't He have us see this from the beginning and enjoy it? What do we understand about this? This is something that distinguishes us from all the rest of nature, is that we have this choice. But why did He give us this choice? I don't think we know, really, basically. Why did He allow good and evil to exist? Shoghi Effendi says the mystery. That is one of the mysteries, the mystery of the existence of good and evil. But it occurs to me that if we are the expression, if we are to be the expression of all the names and attributes of God, one of those attributes is will. And if we weren't given will to choose, we would fall short in the expression of these divine qualities.
But we fall much more behind by having this choice and not having it.
Yes, this is the problem. One of the friends who was studying the writings of the Bab, I think I mentioned some time back, excuse me if I repeat it again, he said that in the writings of the Bab said that man has been created with free will to choose the way of God. It has only one legitimate function, and that is to recognize truth and take a hold of it. If you use this choice for anything else, it's illicit. It's unacceptable. It's deviate from its purpose. It cannot be used legitimately for anything except to take a hold of the Book of God. That's an interesting... Since we say, well, we have choice, so I choose a little of this and I choose a little of that, and after all, God made me do it, you know. He gave me choice. He's announced to us, He says, no, the only choice you have is this choice. Exercise that. Take hold of the Book. Evil is the absence of good. Darkness is the absence of light. Yet, no one would deny that darkness is a very real thing if you're in it. And if you're gripped by the evils of lower nature, it's a very serious affair not to be scoffed at. The Guardian writes in some letters about it. You know, we say evil does not exist in the sense that goodness can dispel it, light can dispel darkness. But that requires all of these steps. It's again, it's like ignorance. Is there ignorance? there's knowledge. And when there's no knowledge present, there's ignorance. But it's not something positive in itself. You can't teach someone to be ignorant. Yeah, you can do a partial job on it. But there are, man has these two qualities, and if he identifies with the animal nature in himself, which is basically me first, and even worse than me first, because he adds the mind, the human mind and its qualities to the animal quality, so it isn't even just me first so I can have my food, it's me first so I can have my food and your food and everybody else's food. You know, there's things that don't happen in the animal kingdom that happen in the human kingdom, and that's evil. It's the use of the human spirit for lower purposes. The forces of darkness, yeah. Yes. Well, we can talk about forces of darkness. We can have a class on forces of darkness. I have a compilation on it from the writing. If you want to find out how to get away from them. One of the quotes of Shoghi Effendi, this is worth thinking about. He says that we should beware lest the forces of darkness enter our lives by feeling and thinking negatively about each other. In a letter written on his behalf. And he talks about this criticism. She wants a date. I'll give you a date tomorrow or something. I have it at the office. It's at the seat. By thinking and feeling negatively about each other. Notice the thinking and feeling. All right, that's all shut up inside us. We're smiles all the time, you know. But we're looking at each other and we're thinking, gee, these people are driving me mad, you know. When are they ever going to do things the right way? Why do they keep... And the end effect is we get darkened. It veils us, in other words, from the light of Baha'u'llah. It removes us. It puts us in the shade. We have to come out into the open again. We have to ask to be... We have to move. We have to pray again. We have to realize I've become a little sunk now and I need to pick myself up again. It's not that dark forces have a personality in themselves, but it's the neglect of our beings to turn towards light and to cling to light and to move towards light.
I have a question concerning what you said about teaching people and studying people first or studying society in order to teach appropriately. And if you don't do this sufficiently, do you think you can damage the faith? Like
if you don't study the people enough and do it in the wrong way, and so that they close up and they don't want to accept anything else that damages it. Well, it's always a gamble, you know, because how are we ever going to know a society thoroughly, and how then within that will you know the whole spectrum of human souls? Because within every culture and society is the whole spectrum of souls. You have to watch the souls a little bit, the individuals, I think. And you have to pray. Pray that you will be assisted to say that which is appropriate. And study the writing so you'll have it in your computer, so to speak. You'll have it loaded in already so it can come out when the time comes. From the whole range of teachings and things, that which is appropriate to say will be able to... You'll be able to use it. And then we pray. We look at the souls, we pray. We're asking Baha'u'llah, assist me as you're teaching. You're turning in your heart and you're saying, Ya Baha'u'llah, let me find the key to this soul. Give me the key. Let me help. I'm standing here dependent on your assistance to touch this heart in the right way. How can I bring this heart to your love? What can I do? And you're listening to this person saying how they're so sad about this or they're upset about that. Because listening is a great way of finding out what you need to say. This is one of the things about direct teaching, where you don't talk to a person before you teach them the faith. It may work and it may not work. Much more effective if you can listen to them a little. Then you'll know how to bridge to their, to where they are, from where the cause is to where they are. Someone will have to do that afterwards. If a direct approach has attracted a soul because they hear the name of Baha'u'llah, you say, have you heard of Baha'u'llah? We're out telling about Baha'u'llah today. You say, no, what's that? They may say, or they may say, no, I don't have time. Okay? If they say, yeah, what's that? Then you have a chance to start. And oftentimes it's good to use questions with people rather than state the teaching. What is their understanding about things? Nobody ever listens to anybody else. But when the Baha'is do a little bit, it just makes the person feel so good, you know? They just say, gosh, somebody seems to be sincerely interested in me, what I think and how I feel, and wants to help me. Because really, that's what we're doing. We're helping. It is the essence of loving kindness to teach the cause. What more generous, kind, loving thing could you do? It doesn't always work out that way immediately. It may put them in big trouble, because now they've heard the call of the kingdom and they have to see whether they're going to rise out of their grave or go back to sleep again. There's all of that there too, but you just keep playing on the trumpet, attracting them into the atmosphere of faith and vision. Well, we're not reading very fast, are we? Hmm. 196. Actually, each one of these sentences could be a class by itself. We've heard before of the fact that there are two books. Abd Abbas says in a tablet there are. God has created two books. He's created the book of Revelation and the book of creation. They're both to be read, and they're in conformity with each other. And as you read the one, you will discover the mysteries of the other. Either way, you read the book of Revelation, creation will unfold its mysteries and meanings to you. You contemplate the world and the universe, and you begin to discover the meanings and implications of the verses of the writing. All spiritual things have been told in the form of letters and words in the realm of creation. Every important statement about the faith is based on some likeness in nature. The sun of truth. The mists and doubts of misgiving. The desert of bereavement. The clouds of divine bounty. The tree of life. Just think about it. Everything is based on things that you can see, because he says that intellectual realities cannot be spoken of clearly. They have to be symbolized. So if the whole purpose of creation is for us to know and love God, and if he is the all-wise, the economy of what he has given us is that everything in the realm of our experience can teach and uplift us, can steer us towards him. So then he ends up saying that every atom becomes a door, leading on to this kind of assurance. Everything. Now, poets sometimes have this vision. Many souls have the vision, but then poets are able to cast it into words in some way. And some of the great Baha'i poets have done beautiful things, you know, talking about these, the meaning of these things. And some of the older poets, the older spiritual poets too. You can find inspiration there and find bridges to people from Christian and Muslim backgrounds. same thing, same teachings. Again, you notice up here this slumber of negligence. Gaflat. This is this negligence, heedlessness. That's the opposite of remembrance. Forgetfulness and remembrance. Do you remember how important this term remembrance is? The remembrance of me is the healer of all thine ills. Do a little compilation. Look for remembrance. You know the word, the original word is zekr. It means also mention, praise, remembrance of God. And the plural of this condition of remembering God, of recalling that we are the breath of God, so to speak, of recalling what our true nature is. The plural of that is azkar, as in mashugal azkar, the dawning place of those experiences, of those praises, of that remembrance of God in its collective expression as a temple, a house of worship. We gather there at dawn to renew our pledge of fealty, of loyalty to Baha'u'llah, to commune with His Spirit and electrified, energized with that Spirit, proceed from there out to the agencies of service to mankind that will be provided around the temples in service to the community. The community will pulse into these hearts, in and out. Every village, town, and city will have its mashugal azkar. This is one of the basic patterns of human existence in the future. I swear by God, were he that treadeth the path of guidance and seeketh to scale the heights of righteousness to attain unto this glorious and supreme station, he would inhale at a distance of 1,000 leagues the fragrance of God, and would perceive the resplendent morn of a divine guidance rising above the dayspring of all things. Well, we'll have to take this up next week to return to our theme here. The stations of absolute certitude. I think in the past we've also talked about these degrees of certitude. These are known traditionally also in the revelations of the past. And Islam has stated them as the certitude of knowing, the certitude of seeing, and the light of certitude itself. This, the example that's given, and the Master refers to this in his tablets too, is, say, in relation to fire. The first, the certitude of knowing, is to know or hear about fire. We are knowing and hearing about the transformation of the human soul in this passage. And he says the next degree is the certitude of seeing, that is actually seeing fire. First we heard about it and heard it described, we understood something about it. Now comes the time we're actually seeing this fire. Quite a difference between hearing about it and trying to imagine what it is and seeing it. And then he says the third stage, which is the light of certitude, the essence of certitude, absolute certitude, burning, becoming fire, burning with the fire. So which is it? That's the question. There are degrees, there are stages. Leadeth him to the stations of absolute certitude. The book of certitude, telling us how to attain this. Well, we'll go on trying to discover something next week.